Next speaker is Paul.
My name is Paul. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank my home group for inviting me to speak. I started drinking in my early teens. It was a love affair from the get-go. I drank whenever I could. By the time I hit my late teens, booze was at the center of my life. I was addicted to it. I abused other substances too. Just let your imagination run a marathon. I partied through the late 60s, the 70s. I was laser focused on the exhilaration of wine, woman, and song. Why deal with responsibilities when there was fun to be had? In my late 20s, the consequences of my drinking brought me to AA. They said, keep an open mind, don't harbor contempt prior to investigation. I put a couple of years together, and I started enjoying some of the early gifts of life and recovery, such as paying my rent. You know, I should get a cookie for that. And after a couple of years, I graduated from AA without doing a fourth step. But I decided, why not? And I drank again. And there were more consequences again. And I went back to AA again. You know, and you heard that. How was it out there? It wasn't good. But after a few years, I graduated again without doing a fourth step again, only to drink again. So what I did is I moved from contempt prior to investigation to contempt after investigation, and I never did the work. And I was oblivious to the progression of my disease. I was stuck on stupid, and I had lost the power of choice. And as my disease progressed, my morals declined. I didn't have to be drunk to do foolish things. I wreaked havoc dry based on decisions, you know, of self and self-seeking behaviors, and I caused harms to family, friends, society, and me. I lost a business I had for 10 years to an employee. You know, think of Jim and more about alcoholism. I stayed in relationships that were sick. I left relationships that could have been rewarding. Legal entanglements, auto accidents, hospitalizations, tax liens. There was a failed marriage, and I told my wife she was a jinx. There were multiple bankruptcies, unemployment. I was suspended from graduate school for a year. I abandoned and scarred for life my two young children. And then gradually, things got worse. Finally, by the grace of God, I had my last drink on September 14th, 2015. That was day zero. I had no intention that day to stop drinking. Day zero occurred 29 years after my first meeting. I don't see a lot of reaction here, so I will repeat that. Day zero occurred 29 years after my first meeting. I don't recommend it. So that day I was with a lady that I was trying to take captive because I couldn't control myself, why not control her? And she told me she had a drinking problem. And so I suggested we go to a meeting because maybe I could work a 13th step. That's a great idea. So God used, now this is incredible, God used this insidious, sinful lust, this character defect, to help save my life. Now, when I had that last drink, I didn't know that September 15, 2015 was going to be my sobriety date. I didn't choose my birthday. I didn't choose my sobriety date for sure. I don't know my death date, but I know that my sobriety date changed my death date. On day two, which was a Thursday, I walked in. I was on 74th Street. I walked into the wrong church and was going to go to a meeting. I walked into the Atlantic Group Beginners Meeting, which is right where I belonged. And I got up there, you know, my name's Paul. I'm an alcoholic. No sponsor, no home group, no nothing. You could hear the room salivate. And it took a while, and I admitted complete defeat. But my ability to work a first step and have that first step experience was only possible because in the hearts of my Atlantic Group fellows, you are having a 12-step experience. And I'm so grateful to you for that. then, so here's the what happened in my story. What happened is that this, you know, something happened. I came to believe something that people in AA had been telling me for years, and that was I was 100% hopeless apart from divine help. There's a poem that reminds me of that second step of experience. If you'll let me, I'll share it with you. It's called Touch of a Master's Hand. "'Twas battered and scarred, and the auctioneer thought it scarcely worth his while to waste much time on the old violin. But he held it up with a smile. "'What am I bidding, good folk?' he cried. "'Who'll start the bidding for me? "'A dollar, then two, only two, $2. "'Who'll make it three? "'Going, going for three, but no. "'From the room far back, a gray-haired man came forward "'and picked up the bow. "'Then wiping the dust from the old, battered and scarred violin, "'and tightening the loosened strings, "'he played a melody pure and sweet "'as a caroling angel sings.' The music ceased, and the auctioneer asked, with a voice that was quiet and low, "'What am I bid for the old violin?' And he held it up with the bow. $1,000, who'll make it two? 2,000, who'll make it three? 3,000, once, 3,000, twice, going, going, and God, cried he. The people cheered, but some of them asked, "'We don't understand what changed its worth?' And quick came the reply, "'The touch of a master's hand.'" And many an alcoholic with life out of tune and with a soul battered and scarred with sin is auctioned cheap to a thoughtless crowd, much like that old violin. A bottle of gin, tornadoes of pain, sweet relationships down the train, and he barely trudges on. He is going once, he is going twice, he is going and almost gone. But the master comes, and the foolish crowd never can quite understand the worth of a soul, nor the change that is wrought by the touch of the master's hand. My journey of recovery began in earnest when I let the master touch my soul and help relieve me from alcoholism. It was giving up Paul reliance for God reliance. And it was making the movement from a belief in God to a trust in God. Today, my life is different. I'm not always happy, but in the Atlanta group, you taught me how to tap into God's power and have.
Oh, Paul, my friend Paul is in there.
Life's storms come along. I've been hospitalized 4 times in recovery, and you supported me, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. I lost jobs in recovery, and you told me to have faith in the Almighty, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. I've lost loved ones in recovery, and you've consoled me, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. I had 10 steps to be heard, and you listened, and you shared your wisdom with me, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. My sponsor handed me an anniversary coin with the statement, "To thine own self be true." Well, the truth can really hurt, but after a 5th step and doing some 9 steps of amends, I can better handle the truth. So tonight, I leave you with the essential truth for me, the truth that I started out my share with you tonight. And that truth is, my name is Paul, and I'm an alcoholic, and I love you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Rachel.
Hi, my name is Rachel. I'm an alcoholic. It's so good to see you all. Thank you so much for asking me to speak. It's always an honor to do service for Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys saved my life and continue to save my life. Little bit about me, just to qualify, I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I've worked the 12 steps. I have a sponsee. I do service at the group level and below the group level. And, you know, I have kind of grown up in this program. I'm definitely really grateful to be here today. For a long time, I thought, like, if you had my life, right, if you grew up in the household that I grew up in, you would be an alcoholic too, right? And I thought, like, that's just, like, the reason is because, like, I had a really hard life. And then when I came into AA, I came into AA for the first time when I was 19. And y'all told me about, like, that threefold disease that I have. And that it's not due to just circumstances of my life. This is a disease that I have in my head. And it kind of, you know, first changed that little perspective a little bit. And, you know, for me, AA is this perspective change, you know? So then I have this obsession that, like, literally I just have to think, like, I want more, I want more, I want more. I need to drink more, I need to drink more. And my obsession for me not only is with alcohol, but it can, you know, then go to other things, or it can think all these negative things about myself and just continue and continue and continue. I also have that compulsion that literally I cannot stop drinking. I would have an enormous amount of alcohol in a night and still need to go to the next bar or to the next place and drink more. I remember I was at a concert one night and they asked me, like, hey, like, do you want a tab? And I'm like, no, I'm just gonna have, like, one, you know, or I'm gonna have two. And I was with friends and they had one or two. And I ended up having so many. The next morning I woke up, there were like 16 receipts, right? Like, I cannot control it. And the third piece for me is the spiritual lack. And when I'm in my alcoholism, I can't think about other people. I can't think about how I'm hurting you. All I can think of is, like, I need to get obliterated. Like, it talks about in the book. Like, I relate to that so, so much. Like, I need to get obliterated. And how can I do that, you know? So I first came into the rooms when I was 19, after my first rehab stint. And, you know, just to zoom past, I got a lot of really wonderful things in sobriety. I went back to college. I got degrees. I got all this stuff. And then I went back out after about 8 years and 3 months sober. And very quickly, I just want to say, for me, it really talks about in the book how if we don't enlarge our spiritual life, like, that is what we need to do, and that's what this book is about. And I want to put that out there because for me, I was doing a lot of the outside stuff still, going to meetings and having service positions and, you know, doing all those things. But I had a lot of anger and resentment at a lot of stuff going on in my life. And I also, you know, therefore was mad at my higher power and wouldn't enlarge my spiritual life. Also, I was like, I got sober so young, you know? So let me tell you, I went out and within 2 weeks, I had a missing persons report out for me in New York City. I was back in detox. And, you know, for me, I just want to talk about, like, the ending for me. I remember I was in the ER. They gave me this piece of paper that says chronic alcoholic on it and suggested I go to AA. And they told me to walk across the detox. I was like, okay, I really want this, you know? But then my brain was like, no, no, Rachel, no, you need a drink. So I went to a bar, I got drunk. It was like 2:30 PM, right? On like a Tuesday. Then my friends brought me back to the ER after I, like, voice noted everyone. And I remember just saying, I'm sober, I'm sober. And I was like screaming this in the ER. And I remember knowing, okay, I know I'm not sober because I can't say my S words, but also the alcohol doesn't work. And I'm still feeling all of the pain and I'm still having all the memories that I was trying to drink to get away from, you know? And then again, my disease, you know, the next day I was in detox and, like, it's like, okay, I really want to be sober, right? But then, like, the things they gave you for the DTs wear off and I was like, oh no, what can I do? So I looked through all the bottles to see what has alcohol in it, and the hand lotion has alcohol in it. So I drank a bottle of hand lotion in detox, right? I have no control over my alcoholism, you know? Anyways, I was like, okay, I have to start this over. You know, I have to do this again. I actually came to the Atlantic Group Tuesday night with my sponsor. I think it was the day I got out of detoxer afterwards, and I was just like crying and sobbing and had a run out. I went back to another rehab facility, and I really like had to like start this program over, you know, and remember that it doesn't matter how much time I had or how much anything. Thank you for the time. I'm an alcoholic like everyone else, and I need to do what I need to do one day at a time, just like everyone. And it was just really humbling for me and really amazing experience. And this has been, I just celebrated 3 years back in June, and it's been really, really special for me and wonderful. You know, it hasn't been easy 100% of the time, but we're not promised, you know, that life is going to be easy. Like, life on life's terms happens. But today, like, I don't need to drink over it. And it still amazes me, and I still, like, get tears that I'm sober today, because it just, like, doesn't make any sense to me, you know? I've been able to do dreams that, like, I've always wanted to do in my life. I've been able to, like, actualize them in New York City, which is amazing. You know, able to begin to really work on like that, like self-compassion, but also really work on, you know, how I can get out of my head and help others, and how my perspective is just always off. Like, it's just always off. And I'm currently working the 12 traditions with my sponsor now, which is really awesome to really like dig deep into that. You know, I still have commitments that, groups and below the group levels, and you know, that really helps me, especially when I don't feel like going to a meeting or I'm in a bad headspace, and it's like, oh, I have these commitments, you know, it's like, oh, okay, I'm gonna do that stuff. And you know, I just am in awe of this program. I remember when I first came in, like years and years ago, I was like complaining about my life and how much everything sucked, and this old guy gave me this book that's like says like a new pair of glasses or something on it. And I was like, I need a new life. Like, I don't need this, you know? And just like learning that, you know, what I really think and what I see is my reality, but I need to kind of look at it and do an inventory. And I'm not perfect, and I don't do that all the time. But when I talk to my sponsor about what's going on, and she helps me, like, I just have a different life and a different peace of mind, you know, and I'm no longer like having to shoulder the entire world, you know, and definitely recently for me, I'm really trying to strive to create like a bigger relationship with my higher power, and to really dive further into that, and meditation, because that for me is like the core and the key of this program. You know, this is a daily reprieve for me continually still. You know, I've been waking up recently, and like the first thing before I put my feet on the floor, I try to pray, you know, even if it's just like, hey, higher power, what's up? You know, I try to say something to kind of connect, just to start my day off like that. And there are certain things in my life that like I would have worried about and would have just like kept on going and going and going, whether it has to do with work or has to do with something else. And now I can like take a pause, which is crazy. I never was someone who could pause. I was always someone who was like, go straight ahead. And also for me, thank you. So I have 1 minute left. Also for me, you know, I was someone that was like, you need to like work hard and do and you do and you do, and then like you'll get results. And like, this is just like letting go and letting my higher power take it. And I'll end on this. I was at the beach this weekend and just like watching the waves go, and like, I was told that's how I need to be, like, just go with the waves. Like, if I go against the waves, it's going to be much, much harder than going with the flow. So, again, thank y'all so much, and it's an honor to be here.
Hi, my name's Steve, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hello, Steve.
Hi, Steve. Glad to be here. God, I was just thinking, I think I was there when Peggy met Clancy and got the idea to start this group in 1988, I think. So I don't see Peggy, but I love Peggy. Anyway, I'm glad to be here. I was looking through the gallery. I have a lot of people I love, and I've done a lot of Zoom meetings like all of us. And every time I go to a Zoom meeting, there's Cynthia. She's at every meeting. She should win an award for the most attendance at Zoom meetings. And then I looked and she wasn't there, but she showed up late. She's looking like two cats today, apparently. But I see her, and I'm very grateful to be sober. My sobriety date is August 10, 1980. So yesterday I turned 40, and it's a personal best. I'll say that. Second place is 12 days. I was so impressed with my 12 days. I drank. Clearly, you can get 12 days. You know, you've proven you're not an alcoholic, and I was really fortunate enough to come back. I have no idea how long between the 12 days, probably a year, it could be a month. Those foggy last years of drinking. But I'm super grateful, and I really, really welcome all the people counting days. One of the great things about AA is we all counted days. No one comes in here with, we all come in here with zero and not staying. But I will promise you one thing, and that is if you don't drink and stay with us, your life will get better. That's a 100% guarantee. Yes, there will be issues, problems, money, heartbreak, illness, hurt feelings, but the graph is up, and I haven't met anyone who went out and was lucky enough to come back and report that it was better out there. Stay with us. Stay. Ask for help. Some people are having a problem being new with it. Go, I don't know if I could have done this Zoom stuff if I was new, and I would think, I would have loved it. It was absolutely impossible for me to walk in a room crowded with people who felt like they were born in the same hospital on the same day, and I was the outsider. And this is, I think, a soft, easy landing for you, and you'll know people when the meetings come back. I finally learned after a while that if I got an early commitment, that it felt more like my meeting. And if I was there early and setting up chairs or making coffee, that people were coming to my meeting rather than coming in late and feeling that awful sense of separation that's so common with the alcoholic. Anyway, I'm super grateful to be sober. I had a little gathering yesterday, and I'm actually capable of loving other people as a result of this program, and I'm capable of feeling the love of other people, and that's quite a change from the guy who got here. I started drinking when I was ninth grade, 13 or 14. I was I had a memory recently to tell you the behavior of the alcoholic. In elementary school, they had on May Day, they had a 50-yard dash, and all the first grade guys would line up and run. And I won it 5 years in a row. And in sixth grade, I came in second. That was the end of my racing career. If I can't win, I'm out of here. And I peaked in sixth grade. I was president of my elementary school, and it was downhill after that. I'll tell you, it was bad. I didn't have a drink. I'll tell you, I judge my life by sides, and I get a side when I'm in an AA meeting. But the first sigh I got was my stepfather would come home from work and hit me fly balls in the park across the street, and I loved baseball. I was a natural player, and that's where I got my sigh. I felt like I belonged on a baseball field as a kid. I started playing baseball, Little League, and I was the pitcher and the shortstop and the best player on the team. I got all my self-esteem. I felt comfortable doing that, and all of a sudden, I got afraid. As you move up in baseball, they throw the ball faster, and I got afraid of getting hit by the pitch. And we can hide a lot of fears, but you can't hide that fear. You're stepping in the bucket. When the pitcher's throwing, you have to step towards the pitcher, and I'm stepping towards my mom. Get me out of here. I'm flinching. And rather than ask for help, and I brought that defect of character in, to AA with me. I picked a fight with the coach and gave up the thing I absolutely love the most. And it took me a long time in sobriety. It is still not natural for me at 40 years to ask for help. It comes a little quicker. But I gave up the thing I loved the most, rather than be embarrassed, rather than look bad. And that's when I started drinking. And I needed a drink. I was born nervous. I was a bedwetter, a teeth grinder, a foot wiggler, ADD, you name it, I had it. I was a kid with orange on his face from eating the pencil. I was the kid they put in the hall. They liked me, but they were trying to teach other kids. I couldn't contain myself. And to go back a little ways, my mom, who's sitting next to me, got married at 19, had three kids. I had a brother and a sister and a father. And the first piece of furniture he picked out for their little house in Montebello was a bar. It's not on the 20 questions, but it could be. Did you buy a bar before you bought a bed? Yes. Check that mark. You belong in AA, priority of the alcoholic. I was just this nervous little guy, and she was to divorce him and marry my stepfather, and he had three kids, and now there's six of us in this house, and the message I got is we're upgrading. He owns a business. Money's going to be, we're going to have a lot of privileges here. And don't jeopardize this upgrade, Mr. Nervous Little Kid. And shut it down. And that's what I did. And we were, and I was doing okay until I quit that baseball team. And the other thing that happened is we were living on the other side of town and we moved to Beverly Hills. And I started high school in Beverly High and in ninth grade. And it felt like everyone had been born in the same hospital on the same day, and I was the outsider, that sense of different separation. Actually, I went to my 50th reunion 6 months or so ago, and actually my feelings weren't that far off. They all went to elementary school together and knew each other. But I felt like an outsider. I met my friend Louie, his father's that famous actor, and Joey, his father's a director, and Lon's father actually owns the Boston Celtics. My father's a drunk. I don't have the DNA to fit in around here. And I hooked up with another guy who just started high school in Beverly High. And we were chatting, and I said, where's your father? And he says, my mom won't tell me who my father is. And I thought, well, I feel better than you. We could be friends. And we started hanging out. And one weekend, he said, you want to go up? Everyone from Beverly goes up to a club on the Sunset Strip. And I said, okay. And we took the bus up there. And it was like everyone knew each other. I go, I got to get out of there. People were even dancing. To this day, if you see me dancing, I have a new sobriety day. And get me out of here. And we went home. And a week later, he said, you want to go back? And I said, no. And he said, my mom's out of town. I have a quart of Smirnoff. And I said, I'll be right down. And I walked down. I remember that day. Some days get imprinted. I believe my higher power imprints these memories. And I remember walking down, remember pouring a whole quart of Smirnoff, a quart of orange juice into a green plastic tumbler and stirring up a half gallon of screwdrivers and drinking three tumblers. And I sighed. This nervous kid just went, and we got on the bus and went back to that club. We're the only two people on the bus, and we lost each other on the way there. But the fear was gone, and I walked into the club that night, and it felt like everyone wanted to meet the new cool kid in town. And I was, that drinking became it. I became the guy who was, every weekend we had some big, cool mansion to party at. There were never any parents around. I would call up the liquor store, Gil Turner's, still there. I drive by all the time just to check I'm giving the right number. And I ordered double what was necessary. There were always 10 or 20 of us at someone's house, and I can't relax up until the day I quit drinking. I cannot relax unless I know I have enough. Cannot. And I drank my way through high school. I had alcohol poisoning at 16, where I'm throwing up liver bile. never drank again, and then decided you shouldn't put water in scotch. It can make you really sick. I drank the next day. I drank my way through high school. I graduated in the lower sixth of my graduating class. I went off to an all-male school in San Francisco with my buddy Joey, and discovered I didn't no longer had to wait for the weekends to drink. And Joey was also hyperactive. His parents had taken him to a shrink, and the shrink had prescribed a medication for him to help with his hyperactivity called Dexamil. It's no longer on the market because of people like me. It's amphetamine and Miltown, a tranquilizer. It increases your vocabulary by 32,000 words. You smoke, you don't need matches, you're just lighting one from the other. You talk. My grades got better, and I was on my way. It was the fun phase of drinking now. I'm in San Francisco, and the party's on, and Fillmore West, and the concerts, and the girls, and alcohol was doing everything I wanted to do. It took away the fear, and I was in college 8 semesters. I ended up going to have 5 and different doctors prescribing to keep the supply of amphetamines going, and I graduated from USC in 4 years with a 3.9, and still the fun phase. It's still going on. I had a pretty girlfriend. I applied to 1 law school. I had no ambition, but my mom said, you have a big mouth, why don't you be a lawyer? That's not a requirement. And I applied to 1 law school, and they took me, and I'm sure they made a terrible mistake. And what happened to me is it, the first day of class, they have this little thing that goes on, the Socratic method, to bring out the legal issue of the case. And my last name is Abram, so I get called first day, first class, contracts, and he calls my name, and you stand up. And I couldn't even be engaged. I couldn't answer his question. I was the kid in the batter's box. I was being publicly humiliated. And I was thinking, everyone said, how did that dumb guy get in here? And he kept trying to get me to draw out the answer. I could tell you the case to this day, but I can't. And he finally gave up on me, and I have a tool for a living now. Class ends, and there's a bar on the corner, and I could pour alcohol, feeling gone. And I got through a couple years of law school, drinking and hiding. I had amphetamines, my grades. I think I was somewhere in the middle of the class, but I know I can't pass the bar. I'm dumb. And what happened to me is a friend of the family enticed me to go to Chicago and work in his car dealership. And that's the end of my fun phase. I went to Chicago. He told me, I'll make you a millionaire by the time you're 30. I guess the word work was implied. I didn't get that part. He thought I should sell cars and learn stuff. And it stopped the fun. You know, I started crashing cars. I got arrested for drunk driving. He sent me to Boston to study a dealership. I was alone in a hotel for a month in Boston, and drinking and getting on the phone and drinking. Came back. I got arrested for drunk driving. Came back, re-enrolled in law school, got within 2 classes of graduating, and didn't show up for an exam, and they flunked me out of law school. And that's true to this day. They fingerprinted me, take the bar, cap and gown, and just didn't finish. And what was going on in my family at the time is, let me go back. I looked like I was going to be a lawyer to everyone looking at me. I had the cool briefcase, and I really looked the part. But when you flunk out of law school that close to graduating, it's like, what the hell did you do? And I had a conversation with my stepfather in the backyard, and it's where we live, in a beautiful home in Beverly Hills, and he couldn't look at me, and I couldn't look at him, because I was ashamed, and he was so disappointed. And soon after that conversation, he went off to play racquetball and had a heart attack and died at 60. And at the time, my mom started drinking, and my brother was doing drugs the whole time. And this wonderful New York man kind of was the glue that was holding us together, and now the family just started flying apart. My mom got into 1/2 gallon of vodka drinking a day, and I'm drinking my fifth of scotch a day, and my brother's on heroin and doing that. And the party was over, and it was grim, and I'd go by and put the key in the back door of this house and say, and talk to God and say, I can't find mom's dead. I am barely hanging on myself. And I went to AA. I don't know. I think my brother had been sentenced there once before, and I called AA. And I went to a meeting. It wasn't far from my house. And I had a couple drinks. I can't be around people without alcohol in me. And sat against the wall, and the speaker probably said 20 things I could have said. I identify me too. But his wife had poured out the booze, and he had drank a mouthwash, and I went, whoa, you know, I'm a scotch drinker, not a scope drinker, so I'm out of here. And I wasn't done, and I drank. I got another drunk drive. The girlfriend left. The party was over. I was in a yellow rocking chair thinking this is not good. I'd watch people in my apartment building go off to work, and I felt like a Martian, like I will never be part of society. I will never... I called AA again. I called them this time. They did it the old-fashioned 12-step call. A guy came out, picked me up, took me to AA. He got talked about his drinking. I talked about mine. I got 12 days, and I figured 12 days, I'm done. And I don't know how much longer it was, but my buddy Joey hooked me up on a blind date with this woman, Nan, and I went out with her. She's pretty... bright and very talented. She still creates and composes music. And I couldn't ask her out on the second date because she may get nosy and say, what do you do? And I drink. That's it. No, I watch Jeopardy. I mean, I'm not just sitting around being an idiot. But I didn't call her. But I called her in a blackout. I don't know how much longer. And I told her I felt like I have a hole in my soul and I can't stop drinking. And she said, I'm in another 12-step program. And if you like, I'll take you to a meeting. And I had my last drink on a Saturday night, August 9th. And I walked over to Sunday Noon, Ohio, which is still my home group. And I sighed and I identified. My take was my life is unmanageable because I'm managing it drunk and people are, you know, all these other steps and people and sponsors and all this stuff. And it's like, well, I just won't drink and life will get wonderful. And I was working in this travel agency and this woman came in and I pursued her. I didn't want a sponsor. I'd heard about them and they interfere with that kind of stuff. And I pursued her and her St. Bernard into the gates of insanity. After I got sober, my mom followed me into AA, and and this woman, we were doing okay for a while, and then she kind of went crazy, and then she kind of got pregnant, and I was like, whoa. She said, I'm going to have a baby, and I'm thinking, I'm a baby. I don't want a baby. I don't have any income. I can't deal with this. She had a baby. My son Max was born on my second AA birthday, and I was probably, I wasn't thinking about drinking, but I was absolutely out of my mind. She needed to have the baby baptized because he could end up in purgatory for 20 billion years. I'm Jewish. I don't know from this, whatever. My mom said, I heard this priest in the AA, and I'll get his number, and you can call him, and maybe you can manipulate him into baptizing Max Abrams. And I called this guy, Terry. And I met him at an AA meeting, and I surrendered. It was probably the most important night of my life. And he spoke at the meeting, and it was outside. And I went up and said, help, I need a sponsor. And I couldn't manipulate him into doing baptizing or anything. And Terry's been my sponsor the last 38 years. And it's been a perfect match for me. He's kind and he's honest. He's never shamed me. Never yelled at me. He's brilliant, and that's been my journey, and everything that can go on in a sober life. You know, being a father. That son turns 38 tomorrow. I can't imagine. You know, we think like being an alcoholic is the worst thing that can happen to us. Being a father is the worst thing. They turn into the biggest gifts. And I cannot imagine my life without my son. He made me a grandfather a year and a half ago and had this adorable, wonderful little granddaughter. And his wife is pregnant again and going to give birth to number two in November. And I, you know, hang in there. Some of the things that seem like curses turn into blessings. I have gone through everything a sober person goes through. You know, I have had financial insecurity. I'm in a business that during the meltdown, I was upside down in panic attacks. And I've been around some wonderful people like Dr. Paulo or Sandy Beach, Clancy, my sponsor. I was at a Sandy Beach retreat, had a big surrender. And the surrender for the money stuff was, you live in the one-bedroom apartment, you got sober, and you couldn't be happier or more hopeful. Anything you have now, you've added on. It's not a requirement. Show up and do the best you can, and God's in charge. And that's kind of the way I feel today, because it's still a business that people aren't spending money on. I went to zero business last March, and I'm okay. I'm doing the one day. I'm finally really getting the one day at a time. I'm not in the wreckage of my future. I was in a long-term relationship that ended, and I was angry and hurt, and I felt like I lived with a knife in my heart. I was with this woman for 17 years, I think, and it ended, and the anger and the writing and the talking and this. And finally, I think the most healing thing I did was I was sitting in my little den with the fire going, and I didn't have anything to read, and I didn't have the TV on, I didn't have any books, and I just sat there and felt the pain. And I think that finally the courage to not run away from a feeling. And I feel like it's peeled away a blockage between me and our greater myself. I think that's what the program's designed to do, is to remove our blockages. When we share our inventory, I've gotten a lot of freedom from making amends and saying I'm sorry. A lot of selfish behavior with women. I wasn't much of a thief, but to apologize for selfish behavior I did. And that's my life today. I'm beyond grateful. You know, I asked a friend of mine, I have a friend sober a long time, and she's not joyful. And I asked a friend of mine, actually, she's not in the program, she's a therapist. And I said, how do people experience joy? And she said, you cannot have joy without gratitude. And I went, wow. I mean, in AA, we talk so much about gratitude. And we all, I mean, during this tricky, troubling, strange time that we're in, you know, we have things to be grateful for. If you're counting days, it's a big deal, and that's to be grateful for. And if the people we love, I mean, one of the good parts is I've able to have long conversations on the phone, whereas in the past, it was like 2 minutes on the phone. And now I call people, I try and call three people every day who I haven't talked to in a while. Some have been years. And it's really been an extraordinary experience. I was able to take my best friend, Joey, got sober, and one day he called and he said, something's going on in my throat. I ended up, he said, will you take me to the doctor? And it became a 2-year trip taking care of him. We were best friends since ninth grade. We talked on the phone every single day that we were in town. And I started this journey with him, and it turned out he had cancer on his lower tongue. And it turned out he was the worst patient ever, he was terrible, but I walked the path. I was someone, if you were sick, I avoided you, because it made me uncomfortable. And my sponsor said, you don't cure the sick, you get them water. I was like, really? He goes, yeah. And I walked the whole path with my friend. Boy, do I miss him now. We would be laughing during this time, goofing on stuff. Anyway, I walked the whole path, and he was a terrible patient, and he was dying. And finally, he was in hospice. And I'll end with this. He was dying, and I was looking at his big green eyes, and I said, "Hey, Joey, I need you to do me a favor." And he looked at me from his bed. Now he's 90 pounds, and he's like, "I don't think I'm in any condition to do you a favor." I said, No. You don't have to get out of bed or anything. But watching this suffering is just really tough. I am so sorry you went through this. And when you leave, send me a message that you're on your way to a better place." Just looking at me. I said, "And don't be a hummingbird or a sparrow, because I won't know it's Joey. Do something big." And he died soon after that. And I was hiking up to Mulholland with my friend Constance. And we were coming down the hill. And it was one of those super moon nights. And I'm relieved that his suffering was over. And we're coming down, and this giant bird lands on top of the tree. And turns around and spreads its wings like this. And I go, "Look, an owl." And she says, "It's Joey, you idiot." And we need each other to point out the spiritual stuff. We don't do this alone. If I was hiking alone, it would be, "Guess what? I saw an owl." But being with another sober person to say, you know, and that's why we need each other. We do not do this alone. I am so eternally grateful to it's 100% not drinking and submitting myself and doing the work and saying yes and being kind, and that's enough for me. Thank you.